Hello, you are listening to KBOO Radio 90.7 on your FM dial in Portland, Oregon. This is your volunteer-powered community radio station. My name is Gene Bradley, and today we have Nathaniel Philbrick coming back to visit us again to talk about his new book, Why Read Moby Dick, which is now in paperback, published by Penguin Books. Mr. Philbrick, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be back.
Thank you for coming around. Now, since 2000, you've written big books about big American stories. You've written about the Mayflower. You've written about Custer's Last Stand. We talked to you about that last time. Your new book is about Bunker Hill. What brought you to Moby Dick and Herman Melville?
Well, I wrote a book in the heart of the sea about the story of a Nantucket whale ship. And by the way, I live on Nantucket. That's where I am right now. And that got rammed and sunk by a whale in November of 1820. And it's the real-life event that inspired the climax of Moby Dick. But where Moby Dick ends is just the beginning of a story of survival when it comes to the Essex disaster, in which the men took to their three whale boats, and after 3 months at sea, only five survivors were left alive. And it was with that book that I got an appreciation for the historical circumstances on which Moby Dick is based. And now that I live on Nantucket, it's the holy ground of Moby Dick, where this is the port of the Pequod, from which Ishmael and Ahab and Queequeg sail. And so I've got a real kind of personal connection to it. But I have to say, with Why Read Moby Dick, I'm making the plea that this is a book that transcends everything. Moby Dick is not just about a whaling voyage. It's about America. It's about the world. It's about the universe and how human beings make their way through a life of change and scary change and make their way into the future.
Now, you begin the book by telling us a little bit about your own relationship with Moby Dick as a teenager. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I grew up in the Nautical Center of the Universe, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. but because my grandparents had a place on Cape Cod, I had learned how to sail, and I just became infatuated with the sport of sailing, even though I lived in Pittsburgh. And I was a senior in high school, like many a senior in high school, I had to read Moby Dick, and I was not particularly looking forward to it until I read that first magical sentence, the greatest first sentence in all of literature, "Call me Ishmael." And in that first page, Ishmael describes the city of New York on a Sunday, in which all of these landlocked laborers make their way down to the Battery on New York Harbor, look out at the harbor and the ocean beyond, and are transfixed by the phantom of life, the sea. And for a landlocked kid in Pittsburgh who yearned to be a sailor, it blew the top of my head off. It was like talking to me. And so I was hooked from the very beginning, harpooned, if you will. And I know I was, I think, the only person in my class that had that reaction. And I cannot blame my classmates, because it's a big, intimidating book. And perhaps 17 or 18 years old is not the time to be introduced to it. But for me, it was love at first sight. I've now read the book, I think I've estimated, at least 12 times. And that doesn't count the times that I just pick it up and dip into it. And for me, it's kind of a personal Bible. Every time I pick it up, I see something new, something different. It's a book where if we bring life experiences to it, I think, you know, if you're in your 30s, your 40s, your 50s, your 60s, or whatever, you have a context that an 18-year-old doesn't. And it will reward you in ways that you cannot begin to anticipate. It's just that good of a book.
Now, one of the things that's fascinating about this book is you start out by talking about your fascination with the events that made this book possible, made the composition of this book possible.
Yep.
Could you talk about how this book in some way reflects the time it was written in?
Yeah, well, you know, I am interested in history, and so it was the historical circumstances of Melville was operating in when he wrote Moby Dick were of special interest to me. And this book was composed in 1850, 1851, and this was the time when America had just instituted the Fugitive Slave Act. which meant that for the first time, a slave that escaped from the South into the North now had to legally be returned to his or her master. And this meant that the North could no longer ignore slavery and say it was a Southern problem. All Americans were complicit, and riots began to rage in Boston. Melville's father-in-law was a lawyer who sat on one of the first cases that in which he was forced to return a slave to the slave owner, caused riots and all this. And this was happening as Melville was composing Moby Dick. What was happening was it was becoming clear that a great and terrible conflict was on the horizon. And sure enough, 10 years later, of course, would be the Civil War. And because of this, Melville, Moby Dick, what it feels like in a deeply cultural and psychic way to be living in a society on the edge of a cataclysm. And as a consequence, this is a book that will always be relevant, because we are always on the edge of terrifying change, yes. Whether it's, the coming World War II or World War I. And I think there's no accident that Moby Dick became newly relevant in the early 20th century with those conflicts. And so inside Moby Dick is so much that will always be relevant. The more the world changes, it seems, the more relevant Moby Dick becomes.
Now, you yourself have lived on Nantucket Island since 1986, 25 years or more. And you talk about how Melville, without having visited Nantucket, writes about Nantucket in a way that forges an American mythology.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that? And
yeah, I think it's almost good that Melville had never visited Nantucket when he wrote Moby Dick. For me, it was a personal disappointment. I sort of, when I'm moving to Nantucket, I thought, oh, well, at least Melville had written about it. But for Melville, Nantucket is a stand-in for much more than any one island or even any one country. It is a concept. It's a rhetorical conceit in which he channels all of the energy, rage, opportunity, and idealism that is in America, that was behind a revolution in 1775, that would climax so tragically in the Civil War 10 years later. It's all in Moby Dick. It's kind of like he's been able to channel the DNA of America and transmit it through his art in this story of a whale ship bound for the Pacific. And so it transcends any one story. It's in there is America, and that's why it's so relevant. And it's kind of a repository. When I say repository, I don't mean it's static in any way, because it's always telling a story and moving, even thrusting into the future. But it's a story that is as relevant and as complex, and yet remains entertaining as anything can be.
Now, one of the most curious things about Moby Dick and Herman Melville is it didn't end the way it started out.
Yeah.
He was a best-selling author who had written about his own experiences as a whaler, and this was in the summer of 1850. Just finished his first draft almost of another whaling story, and he met Nathaniel Hawthorne, and that changed everything. Could you describe?
Yeah. Yeah, well, as you say, in August of 1850, he had basically finished what was going to be a very conventional novel about whaling. And then he is on summer vacation in the Berkshires in western Massachusetts when he meets Nathaniel Hawthorne, who had just published the bestseller Scarlet Letter, was then at work on his next book, The House of the Seven Gables, and he's 15 years older than Melville, who was in his early 30s, and Melville was moved to read Hawthorne's short stories, and what he saw changed everything. He would write an anonymous review that would appear that August about the power of blackness that's in Hawthorne's novel, short stories. And what he began to do was completely reconceive his whaling novel. This seems to have been the genesis of the character of Ahab, the man who channels the darkness in Moby Dick And so he would basically rip apart the novel he had begun and reconceive it along entirely different lines. And that winter, he would move his family to the Berkshires, buy a farm that he could not afford, and begin to write Moby Dick and go through this 9 months of creative, furious invention with Hawthorne as his friend. Go over there and they'd talk. We have letters from Hawthorne's wife describing these visits. And in that 9 month period, Moby Dick would be created. And so in Why Read Moby Dick, I am as much interested in the personal circumstances as the historical circumstances under which the book was written. And the letters Melville would write to Hawthorne during this period are just as good as anything in Moby Dick. They're full of the same energy and passion. And it's really kind of moving that this personal friendship between two very different people. Melville was passionate and as Sophia Hawthorne would say, had life to the fingertips, while Hawthorne, although older, was very timid, almost very shy and retiring. And yet the two of them forged a friendship that created a masterpiece.
Now, you say that basically Melville's relationship with Hawthorne gave him emotional inspiration. It wasn't that he was following Hawthorne's craft or, style as a writer, but that there was some power of darkness that he saw in Hawthorne's work that gave him either the idea or the permission to write a completely different kind of book.
Yeah, and you know what it was Melville was also reading Shakespeare at this time. And it was the dark tragedies, Lear and Macbeth and Hamlet, that were appealing to him. But it really wasn't until he met Hawthorne that that he found a friend, a sensibility in the present that gave him. Sanctioned him almost in going to places he had previously not dared to go. And in the review of the synonymous review of Hawthorne, he would write about Shakespeare and about how it's the dark things in Shakespeare, the things that he couldn't dare even to write, that are the most important. And it's basically a blueprint for what would become Ahab. It's tragic in a way because it would lead to this masterpiece, but it would also lead. But because the book is so complex and has its darkness and yet has its light as well, but it would baffle the audiences of the day. Hawthorne apparently appreciated it, as did his wife, but they were about it. And so it led to great despair, I think, in Melville's personal life later on, because he knew he had created a masterpiece. But the novel would fall on deaf ears, and the rest of his life would not go well artistically. And yet he would continue to write and continue to write well. But it's this personal relationship that I think is such an interesting perspective when it comes to this novel that can be so intimidating. But it is a novel based on the barest and most direct personal relationship.
Now, one thing that is so striking reading your book is to realize what Melville went through as he was rewriting this book. And almost his identification with Ahab.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons why the novel gets under our skin in such a way is that, Ahab is a despicable character in so many ways. He hijacks his vessel and takes it on a voyage that will lead to the deaths of nearly everyone. He's a maniac. And yet, there's a great nobility in him. There's an undeniable charismatic quality about him, and there's a pathetic nature about him, and there's all he's so multifaceted, and I think Melville clearly identified with Ahab. It was absolutely outrageous what Melville was proposing to do which was to support himself and his family in the wilds of Massachusetts by writing a novel of all things, whaling. You know, there were very few professional writers at this time in America. It was hard, unless you were Charles Dickens, it was hard to support yourself as a writer. Right. And yet he was going to do it. And so the resolve that led him to do this was as insane in its own way as anything Ahab was being driven by when in his pursuit of the white whale. And so, yes, I think there is a real identification there. And that's why it works so well, because it's so tortured and desperate, really, because there's so much longing in this novel. It's so much, you know, of wanting things to be different from the way they can be. And that is so much the story of the human condition. We lead lives limited by death, and yet wish to live forever. And this is the great desperate condition that makes us human.
Most of us who were dragged to Moby Dick at an early age have a pretty clear memory of Ahab. But it seems to me as if every time you read Moby Dick, Ishmael is a new creation. Yeah. I mean, he stands as such a counterpoint to Ahab. Can you describe what it meant for Melville to write about Ishmael and what Melville got from Ishmael?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that Ishmael is the sole survivor of this voyage. And there's got to be a reason why, you know, he is the one person. And his voice is something to listen to very carefully, because he is someone who... the novel begins in a very sort of like a buddy flick. It's Ishmael and his pal Queequeg, cannibal friend, and off they go on a whaling voyage. And it begins in a light-hearted manner, a very funny way. And that's Ishmael. There's sort of the Holden Caulfield about him as in Catcher in the Rye, and yet then it goes into the darkness as we confront Ahab. Ishmael provides us with a perspective that can contain evil get pulled gravitationally in its direction. And yet we always have a sense that Ishmael retains his own identity. He is pulled into the orbit of Ahab, and yet he remains at the end to tell us the tale. And his spirit has a buoyancy. It's sort of like he is saved by Queequeg's coffin life buoy. And I think that that's a metaphor in many ways for Ishmael, who can go down into the depths and yet has the resiliency to pop up and tell the tale. So I think Ishmael is the character for me that provides, whose life, whose kind of attitude can serve as kind of an instruction manual in this terrifying ordeal we call life.
You write that Moby Dick was actually written for the future. It was not a success when it first was published. 100 years later, people began to really understand it as a primary American story. What exactly did you mean it was written for the future?
Yeah, well, it's a novel that is experimental in a way that I don't think could be appreciated until after society had gotten beyond the cultural and historical circumstances under which it was written. When we're time-bound, we have no sense of really what is going to work on down the line. When Shakespeare wrote his plays, he was just one playwright, and he might have been a popular playwright, but there was no telling at that moment who was really built for eternity. Melville's novel is built for eternity, and the fact of the matter is, when we're living in the circumstances of life when he was writing it, that was not apparent in any way. In fact, it was forbidding and confusing. And so he latched onto the essential elements of life. Without getting it's so hard for us at any point to sort of get beyond the claptrap of culture and sort of get down to the essence of what's really going on. And Melville did that. And so that the farther we get from the time Melville wrote Moby Dick, it's almost like we're gaining in accessibility when it comes to this novel, because he so clearly...
Well, I just want to thank you for writing this book. We've been talking to Nathaniel Philbrick about his book, Why Read Moby Dick, which has just come out in paperback. published by Penguin. And I have to admit, having read your book, I am once again reading Moby Dick. So
great. Well, mission accomplished.
the magic works.
So, all right. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us again on KBOO, and we hope you come and talk to us again.
Stand you there on the deck in my place.
Boy!
Captain Pip.
Oh, did you see him, man? Did you see his hump like a great snow hill? Did you see the way he slides along? Oh, there's majesty for you. Don't look. I'll look for you. Did you see the lances in his back? My lances. Mine. Struck in him years ago.
Heads, my lads. Rack the oars up. Lay into it. Pull there, boys. Pull, you green-faced posies.
Long and strong, men. Shake your bones, men. Break in two. Come, Moby Dick. Show your chump. Blister your lungs. We'll dam off your blood for
soft now. He's out. Ship oars.
Thank you.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. Shocks of Sheba has also been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Welcome to Shocks of Sheba.
Sound of waiting nation from station to station, as I would say, for the younger vibration. But I tell you, this a rocking vibration. Oh, say that the people, are you ready? Whoa! Oh, Lord, come and we do jam down rock steady. Whoa! Oh, Lord, say that the people, are you ready? Whoa! Oh, Lord, come and we do jam down rock steady. Whoa! Oh, Lord, come and we do it like
it. say you practice at all. Step it in a peace and love.
All right, Prince Muhammad right there, also known as George Nooks. That's called People, Are You Ready? Welcome, everyone. This is Shocks of Sheba.
Yes, indeed. Are you ready for some great reggae music to your head top? We're going to be here till 2 p.m. today and are glad you're listening. We will bring you some fine music, so do stay tuned. Right now, here's a nice 12-inch single from Ronnie Davis.